TED Audio Collective.
Hi, I'm Debbie Millman. Canva is great for designing visual content for work, no matter what industry or department you work in. Nail your next presentation with Canva Presentations. Start with a professionally designed template and use it as a springboard for your design. It's a serious time saver. Time to present but can't be there in person? Enter Canva Talking Presentations. Record yourself presenting and add your talking head to your slides so your audience can watch your perfected presentation anywhere, anytime. Start designing today at canva.com. Designed for work.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
This is Design Matters with Debbie Millman from DesignObserver.com. On this program, Debbie Millman talks with Jen Beckman about how she went from being an internet entrepreneur in the early days of social media to an art dealer with a gallery and a major website.
There are a lot of people out there who could be buying art who don't because nobody's trying to sell it to them. I describe the least expensive print as being like the gateway drug of the art world.
Here's Debbie Millman.
The door to Jen Beckman's gallery says, "Live with art. It's good for you." It's something that Jen Beckman herself truly believes, and it's the philosophy that propelled her from a successful internet career into an even more successful career in the art world. Her company, Jen Beckman Projects, shows art at the gallery, promotes photography in a competition called Hey Hotshot, and sells limited edition, low-cost art on a site called 20 by 200. It's that last project where Beckman has truly extended her philosophy. Because if art is good for you, then everyone should be able to afford it. Beckman says it's a way to support artists and to make collecting fun. Jen Beckman, welcome to Design Matters.
Thanks. I'm excited to be here.
So I understand you went to Stuyvesant High School. So does that mean you're a native New Yorker?
I am. I was actually just talking to the cab driver about that, who was somewhat incredulous. But I'm a native New Yorker from Queens. I grew up in Forest Hills.
Yes. And, you know, I'm a native New Yorker as well.
I didn't know that.
We are probably two of the few native New Yorkers in the entire
We're a rare breed these days.
Of Manhattan right now. So you graduated from Hunter College in
New
York City.
You didn't actually graduate. I didn't graduate. I'm a dropout. I was a terrible student.
Why?
I think the same reason that I am kind of a terrible employee.
Authority issues?
Just authority issues and structure. I'm not a good structure person, which makes it really hard to edit me as well, as the people who work with me for writing stuff will attest. I was sort of ADD before ADD was talked about, and I just have my own path, I guess.
So when did you decide to drop out? What year in your college education were you in?
I actually stayed in and out for almost 4 years altogether, but I had a lot of incompletes.
Oh, okay. I think that's what confused me when I saw your college education parentheses in 4 years. I just assumed.
Right. Which was great when I first started my career that I attended for 4 years. There was some careful wordsmithing.
Good to know.
Now I'm proud.
So after finishing your college experience, you went headfirst into the internet boom. You were chief creative officer at Earthnoise, senior manager of community development at Netscape, director of interactive programming at Disney, VP of user development at Meetup, cruise director at New York Online. What is a cruise director?
Well, so New York Online was actually where I started doing internet stuff. That was a first-class BBS, if you remember a time before the web. And
I'm teasing. I'm old.
But the cruise director, I mean, basically, we joked around that I was sort of like Julie, making sure that all the passengers were having a good time. I was a community manager director, I manage the community and dealt with everything from sort of moderation issues to setting up partnerships and things like that.
So almost all the places you worked were precursors to the big internet successes. Earth Noise was a predecessor of sorts to YouTube.
Yes.
Meetup is sort of a Foursquare meets Match.com meets.
And it's still, Meetup is an interesting business too because it's an 11-year-old internet business and it's become sort of synonymous with getting together offline with people that you find online, which is much less novel these days. So they were early.
Was your entry into the internet world more a result of timing, or was it something that you planned or knew while you were at Hunter that you wanted to do?
Oh, no. The internet didn't really – the web didn't exist at the time that I started working in the internet, and I really had no idea what I wanted to be when I grew up.
Nothing? Never?
When I was very young, my idea of what I wanted to be was to get paid to read magazines.
So like maybe a fact checker?
Kind of. I mean, I just, my stepfather calls me the zine queen because I always had stacks and stacks of periodicals and 7 Days,
Spy, 7 Days, Adam Moss. Yeah.
Paper, when paper was on paper.
Paper.
I was really into magazines, and I think that it was sort of the mix of design and culture and also kind of business. I always sort of look at things on a couple of different levels, and that was sort of my idea. And there weren't jobs reading magazines. I actually kicked around after I dropped out doing a few different things. I worked at a jazz publishing house. I was a switchboard operator for Ian Schrager's hotels. And Schrager, he sort of pioneered the concept of the boutique hotel. Schrager was sort of popularizing the idea of high design on a budget. And I do think that that had an influence on me, and it was definitely something that interested me. And then the internet stuff started because I reconnected with a friend of mine who I'd gone to high school with, Omar, who was the founder of New York Online, Omar Wasso. I worked with him for a long time, and it was like I finally found what I wanted to do. I remember my first sort of email exchange with someone, and I was like, wow, it's a direct connection between my brain and somebody else's brain. And it's writing that can be spontaneous. And as a communication medium and sort of the immediate gratification, I just was really hooked. And I think the fact that it was new and there weren't rules really made it possible for me to navigate it in a way where nobody knew what they were doing. So I didn't have to follow somebody else's structure. And the fact that I'm sort of resourceful and scrappy served me well because I was working in places where we were all figuring stuff out together.
I love that you remember your first email exchange.
It was this guy. It was this guy who lived in Austin who was the ad sales director for Fringewear, which was this – it was a magazine. But it was really – email was this really powerful thing for me. And it – to me, the power of the internet always has been and will always continue to be its ability to connect – like-minded people who might find it hard to connect otherwise. And I think that a lot of that had to do with the fact that New York Online, one of the things that distinguished it at the time was that it was over 50% people of color who were participating in online community. And in 1994, 95, it was a very interesting swath. And it was a lot of people who had grown up, a lot of people in that community had been like the one black kid in their class at Harvard, or like they had IV educations and they had spent a lot of time feeling isolated. And this was a big community for connection that always sort of impressed me. And it's still to me to this day, no matter how obscure your idea or interest is, whether it's, something that you collect that you can find scads of on eBay or some weird fetish that you have or some, interest in typography, or you can always find a community of people.
It seems to me that one of the common denominators in your career then, as varied as it's been, is accessibility.
Yes. And I've been in the art business for the gallery's 10-year anniversary will be next year. So March 15th will have been open 9 years. So it still feels very new to me, but I've been in the business for a while now. And accessibility and affordability, it's very hard to couple those either of those words with art and not have it seem to compromise credibility in some way.
Well, good art is supposed to be expensive.
Right.
Good anything is supposed to be expensive.
Right. And yet the expense of something is often more of a reflection of someone's ego than it is maybe the inherent quality of the object that's expensive.
Isn't that interesting that we validate ourselves and feel good about ourselves based on how much prestige is associated
right.
with it?
Listen, I gravitate towards expensive things all the time. I can't lie. But I'd like to think that it's because there's a quality of craftsmanship or because there's some value beyond the status of it. But, you know, the art world has throughout history, it's kind of created value by scarcity. And one of the ways to create that scarcity is to make it inaccessible to most people so that the people who are spending feel really special.
Well, I want to talk about your path to opening Jen Beckman Gallery.
Mm-hmm.
I read that in 2000, you were 31 years old, earning six figures,
yes.
overseeing a staff of 30 people and working toward the promise of a huge stock windfall. And as you described it, then the bubble burst and you watched your stock options, your identity,
mm-hmm.
and your future plans disappear overnight. And you also said that you thought that at that point in your life, you had it all figured out and you knew what your path was going to be. Then the company that you're working for goes out of business. At the time, I believe they owed you $40,000.
Yes.
What did you imagine your path was going to be before that happened? If you knew where your path was going to be, did you imagine it as an internet entrepreneur? Did you imagine it as sort of a rich.com maven?
The company that I was working with at that point was Earth Noise. And as you referred to earlier, it was a company where you could upload and share your video on the internet.
Mm.
It was 2000, however. So it was
pre-YouTube,
yes,
pre-William Gibson's footage.
It was really early.
Heads.
But it was an AOL-funded company in the middle of, like, you know, kind of go-go web 1.0. And so when I took the job, I moved back from the West Coast to take this job, sort of thinking it was funded, we would do another round of funding, we would get acquired, I would earn out my options and, you know, somewhere a few years ago, be retired and learning to play the cello again, which I gave up in junior high school and always regret. And, you know, I think that part of the crisis for me when it all fell apart is that the internet was such an epiphany for me because I really didn't know what I wanted to be when I grew up until the internet presented itself to me. And I was so excited about it. And so to get to a point where so much of my identity and so much of the success that I had in my life was no longer an option. And also to feel like I had been running so fast. I mean, this is one of the things I think about a lot is like I've been running so fast for so many years at that point. And I was always very focused on where I was getting. And I never really took the time to let myself feel like I had accomplished anything.
Why?
Well, I'm definitely like a pretty driven person.
No. You think?
I'm like, and I think that, like, but I also think, you know, I didn't have a college degree. And when I worked at Netscape, everybody in my group was an MBA. I had an inferiority complex. And like, I never stopped to kind of recognize the accomplishments as I went. And when it kind of fell apart, I thought, wow, I peaked. And I didn't even know that it happened. And I felt kind of dumb for not enjoying the things that I had achieved as I was achieving them.
Did you really think that that was going to be your highest moment?
When Earth Noise went out of business, owing me $40,000, I was completely burned out and I was unemployed for 18 months. And I really didn't know like what I was going to do. And so I did kind of think maybe this was, you know, at least I wasn't the high school football captain. But I really did.
I love that you said football captain as opposed to homecoming queen. I
will
love that.
Never be a homecoming queen. All my guy friends in New York might be homecoming queens. But no, but I really, I did. And in retrospect, I'm really glad it happened because it was, I hesitate to say humbling because it's to me an infuriatingly often bandied about, oh, it's so humbling. It's like the humble brag. No, it was really humbling. Like I was seriously cut back and, you know, but it in many ways, I think it taught me to be the entrepreneur that I later became because, you know, like one of the things I talk about with my team and one of the things that I sort of like my inner coach is always telling me, you know, at the end of every day, there's always going to be a really long list of what you didn't get done. But looking at that list doesn't help propel you forward, whereas looking at what you did get done gives you the energy to go tackle more the next day. And so I always have a sort of interior dialogue with myself about kind of future tripping versus living in the moment and trying to enjoy things as they are right now. It sounds kind of corny, but...
No, I completely relate. Completely relate. Now, so you were unemployed for 18 months, and somehow between the time you left Earth Noise and started your gallery, you made the decision to go from the internet to a bricks and mortar.
Yes. Well, so there was – so what happened, I was unemployed for 18 months, and then I went back to Meetup as the VP of User Development, where on paper it was the perfect job for me. And that was sort of like peak disillusionment because it was a disaster. It was like it just did not work. And Scott Heiferman, the CEO, who's now my dear friend and actually invested in 20 by 200, he fired me. And, you know, someone who was like the queen of online community for years to go be the VP of user development at a company that was all about connecting people, for that to not work for me, you know, I really like I didn't know what to do. And when Scott let me go, I kind of decided that I was going to cash out my 401k at that point because it was very little money. I think it was like
$20,000.
Yeah, it was like $20,000. I was like, well, I could live on this for another year in like this scrappy sort of way. Or, I mean, it's actually sort of absurd that I thought that I could do anything significant with that little money. But somehow it worked. I don't know why the people who gave me the lease on the gallery gave me a lease. They shouldn't have, because the security deposit was $12,000.
So you maxed out your credit cards. You took your $20,000 out of your 401k. This is after already losing $40,000.
Yes.
And opened the Jen Beckman Gallery.
Yes.
Now, you did this at a time when you didn't have a single piece of art hanging on your walls of your apartment.
Yes.
Why a gallery in the first place?
I had a friend who was an artist. I had several friends who were artists. And I sort of became aware through my relationships with them how hard they worked and how hard it was for them to translate that hard work into an environment where they would be shown professionally. And then on the other side of it was the fact that no one had ever tried to sell me any art before. And the art that was available to me was, you know, I always talk about like looking at a Pottery Barn catalog and just feeling sort of intellectually insulted by what
well
was being
said.
Made available to me. And I was like, well, this is just wrong. And so naturally, I opened a gallery.
Of course. I see that as a natural next step.
Yes. I mean, it was just one of those. I mean, nobody thought I was serious, but it was really like it was a conversation. And in that conversation over the holidays, I was like, well, I would want to either be on Prince between Elizabeth and Bowery or Spring between Elizabeth and Bowery. And then on January 5th, I went for a walk with my friend and I found the storefront on Spring between Elizabeth and Bowery. So everything just sort of fell into place, even though it seemed like it shouldn't.
Well, it did and it didn't. I mean, from what I understand, when you first started, the only way that you were able to keep the gallery afloat was to sublet your apartment in the East Village and spend nights on an air mattress in your mother's apartment in Queens.
Yes.
So that's not immediate, overnight. This
right.
was meant to be, let's cheer in the streets.
I'm very stubborn. And it just was never an option for it not to work. And it's funny, like, I look back and I don't actually know how I sort of kept going because it was kind of crazy. But I was very determined to figure out a way to make the idea work.
Now, not to be a real buzzkill, but I do want to spend a couple of more minutes on the struggles that you went through because it's extraordinary. I have watched your career. I was a big fan when you were the editor of Unbeige, the founding editor of Unbeige. I had no idea that any of this was going on simultaneously while you were the founding editor of Unbeige, the design blog.
That was the gig I took to try to freelance so I could have some money to pay rent.
Well, because I read at the lowest point, you were 8 months behind in rent at the gallery.
Yes.
You were 4 months behind in rent at home. You had tens of thousands of dollars in credit card debt.
Yes.
And you felt like the Willy Loman of the art world, always about to get your big break, which in many ways I think is incredibly optimistic, even to be thinking that that big break was still going to come.
Optimistic, delusional.
I mean, was there ever a time where you said, when do I give up? Were you ever on the verge of giving up hope?
It was never about hope. It was about determination. I think that even the people closest to me just thought it was ludicrous. But I could not imagine getting a job. I could not imagine going back to work. And also, you know, my parents, I just felt like if I failed, I would never hear the end of it from them.
I love that. And like, what fuels success? Our parents' approval.
But I really just like, I felt like I couldn't imagine like sitting at Thanksgiving dinner hearing about the folly of me opening this gallery. Like it just, and it was just not an acceptable outcome for me. And, but also I really believed in what I was doing and was so delighted by what I discovered at working with artists. And I feel like art and artists are very misunderstood in our culture.
Why is that?
Because I think that part of the American, we have this ethic of, you know, purpose and utility, and art is not useful in a very direct way. And I think that also, you know, our concept of artists is that they're lazy somehow and that they don't want to work hard. And in fact, you know, what I discovered from working with artists is that most artists by and large are not doing it because they want to be the next Andy Warhol. They're doing it at huge personal expense and sort of struggling to keep a practice going while trying to figure out how to make ends meet. They're not making art because they want to make money. They're making art because they have something to say that they want to share with the world. And I also think that people don't understand the value of art. As you mentioned, like, I didn't have any art on my walls. And living with art, my life is better because of it. And for something that I see as kind of such a joyful thing, essentially, that the business itself is so ugly, seems very wrong to me. And that so many people are shut out of this thing that can, like, and I always feel corny when I talk about it, but like it's very sincere. Like I see art as essentially a joyful thing. And I think that right now most people are robbed of a simple joy that could make a big difference in their lives. Having a piece of art on your wall that makes you feel good is nice. It's a small pleasure.
And so that's why you started 20 by 200.
Yes.
So how did that idea even come to be in your psyche?
I opened the gallery with very similar goals to the goals that underpin 20 by 200, which is, you know, I wanted to create this place where people would feel comfortable buying art. What I didn't anticipate was how intractable the baggage that people have about art is, and how no matter what I did, people came in with expectations about who I was going to be as a gallery owner, what the gallery was going to treat them like.
So your brand, so to speak.
Yeah. No matter what I said, you know, no matter it, you know, it does say live with art, it's good for you on the door. We do say hello to people when they walk in. But at the same time, it was also very important to me that we're a gallery. And so it's, you know, it's a relatively austere space and we have checklists and, you know, and I think it's very intimidating for people. And so I would see people not buy stuff and I would think like if I could just convince them of how cool it was, but realizing that I couldn't do it within that environment and also that I couldn't do it within that environment at the scale that I wanted it to be at. And also having been sitting on the sidelines of the internet for many years at this point, which was a little frustrating for me, I thought, well, I could do, like, I described the least expensive print as being like the gateway drug of the art world.
I love that.
It's like, get people hooked on the good stuff and then like know that they're going to be hooked and kind of we're less opportunistic. You know, we're sort of it's a good addiction.
So it sort of takes the words art dealer to a whole new place.
Exactly. And like to me, it was very important that if we deliver, you know, a quality art product at a price point that is sort of like lunch in New York City, that people would be able to connect with the kind of joy that I feel living with work or whatever, and that as they became more comfortable, that they would take bigger risks. You know, I opened the gallery because I was very much aware of the opacity of the industry and how intimidating it was. And I realized that sort of face-to-face was not the place to work it out. And I was just talking to somebody earlier today saying that, you know, it turns out that the intimacy of your inbox is actually kind of a great place to, like, address people about these issues. And so, you know, the business at its inception was very newsletter driven. And it was me writing to people talking about art and, you know, trying to balance talking about it in a way that is, you know, credible and respectful and about the art and the artists, and also saying, you know, sometimes I like stuff because it's green. And that's okay. And I think that a lot of people want to be given permission or need to be given permission to like things. because they think that there's a whole set of rules that there's not.
And yet art is so subjective.
It is subjective. And I think that a lot of people like to characterize me as wanting to tear down the traditional art world and, you know, obviate the need for high-end galleries. And I absolutely have no interest in that whatsoever. But I also think that anyone who wants to tell me that I can't have a picture of a cute baby animal on the wall next to my Ed Ruscha print can go fuck themselves, because like they both make me really happy.
Absolutely.
And I think it's okay. Like, and I think it's actually good. And, you know, art has to make you happy. And, you know, I think that part of that experience is knowing why you like it and also understanding why the person who made it and all that stuff. So those are all the different types of things that we're trying to address with people when we share work with them on the site.
So for my listeners that might not be familiar with 20 by 200, can you describe it for us?
Yes. 20 by 200 is a website where we sell affordable limited edition prints, and we release new editions weekly, and subscribers to our newsletter get the announcements first. And every time we release an edition, there's a very affordable version available, and prices go anywhere from $24 all the way up to $10,000. So every time we release a new image, the idea being that if you're a brand new person, you might have access to an 8x10 print that's very affordable. If you're someone who's a more serious collector, you know, a 30x40 print that's an edition of two that's $2,000 is actually a value as well. And we work with artists at all stages of their careers. We've worked with a lot of emerging artists, but we've also worked with very established artists like William Wegman or the Starnes.
Lawrence Weiner.
Marian Banchies has an edition with us. Paula Scher has an edition with us. And a lot of what drives us is also saying that this is not just for some rarefied fraction of the world, that this is something that everybody can get excited about and interested in and enjoy.
I read that you said if you rely on the art rags or say the New York Times for news about the art world, it's easy to get the impression that art is for the very few.
Yes.
Not even scads of money can get you the art you want. You need clout, cachet, or pedigree. So I love the idea that your own issues with authority have allowed you to provide a service to people that might not necessarily have issues with authority, but very well may be intimidated by not having clout, cachet, or pedigree to enter the art world.
I'm a business person, too, clearly. And, you know, to me, part of what I find incredible about the way that the art world has functioned to date is there are a lot of people out there who could be buying art who don't because nobody's trying to sell it to them. When I talk to people who have six-figure salaries who think that the only place they can go buy art is IKEA, I find that galling. But I also see a huge opportunity in that. And to me, the opportunity is both to make their lives better, but also to support artists in their practice and trying to figure out a way to get art into people's hands and then to pay the people who make that art.
Right, and make them some money as well.
Yes.
Now, you started 20 by 200 in 2007, so
yes.
It certainly wasn't at the apex of your success at the Jen Beckman Gallery.
No.
How long did it take to catch on? How worried were you at the beginning that this might not catch on?
I never worried for a second.
Really?
It really just fell into place as an idea. And I actually, like, I came up with the name during an IM conversation with Kate Bingham and Burt. And I registered the domain name while I was talking to her. But it was just very clear to me that it was going to work. And I think the fact that it was clear to me was what helped me rally the support to make it happen. Because I didn't have one thin dime to make it happen with. And, you know, this was not the time that I maxed out my credit cards. My credit cards were maxed.
I was imagining that the case.
It was a cash business, 100%, which is, it was hard. But it started working very quickly. And, you know, the overhead was not high. To me, this is sort of the definition of Web 2.0 in a lot of ways. We launched the site using movable type and Google Checkout. I didn't hire our developer full time until almost 2 years later when we had closed financing. So, you know, I didn't have a staff of people who had to update the website. We made blog posts and Google handled the transactions. So, you know, it was a time when you were able to kind of bootstrap stuff and it didn't demand the resources that you know, even like a few years earlier, it just would have been impossible.
What was the first print you sold?
The first print we sold was Man Shroom, which is by this artist. It was a collage. It was a print based on a collage, and it sold to my friend Alex Soth, who's a photographer, who has a publishing company now called Little Brown Mushroom.
Nice.
Making it appropriate that he bought the mushroom print. So,
and was the first series profitable for you?
The site, the idea of it at its inception was, it was very clear to me. I was going to email the announcement to the mailing list, and it was going to sell out. And that was, by and large, how it worked from the get-go. What I didn't anticipate was what would happen when it sold out. And so a
what
few,
happened?
Well, people started talking about how, if you don't know Jen, you can't get a print. And I was like, wait, time out. Like, this
is, haters gonna hate. You know?
But it was also the antithesis of what
right, of
I
course.
Wanted it to be. And also, the businesswoman in me was like, I am leaving money on the table when people discover the site for the first time and they come here and they see all this stuff and there's nothing for them to buy. So about a year into the site's launch, the initial structure was always $20 prints, edition of 200, $200 prints, an edition of 20, and $2,000 prints in an edition of 2. The other problem with that from a scalable business perspective is that the maximum value per individual edition was $12,000. That's not art for everyone. It's art for more than most. But so we introduced new edition sizes, the most important one being the editions of 500 $50 prints that are 11 by 14s. And there was a lot of anxiety within the company about breaking our formula. And I was like, you know, this is going to work. And if it doesn't work, we don't have a business because it can't work otherwise. And it, you know, introducing that drastically transformed the economics of the business on an individual print level. And it also meant that there was inventory available to people when they came to the site for the first time. We're still catching up with that. I mean, you know, the site was designed to be a repository. It was almost an archive of previous editions because everything was happening in the newsletter. And then we kind of switched to this having inventory and like creating opportunities for people to browse. And that's all stuff that we're still evolving now. But at that point, built into it, it just had the capacity to be a real grown-up business and, you know, sort of started accelerating from there forward, I guess.
The last number I could find online was that since you've launched, 20 by 200 has sold more than 65,000 prints.
Are you ready?
I'm sitting here holding the seat.
This week, this actually, like literally before the end of the month, I think we'll hit 170,000.
Jen Beckman.
It's very exciting.
Jen Beckman.
It's very exciting. Part of what's exciting to me about that is that it's like, again, it sounds corny, but it's 170,000 stories. It's like a piece of art in someone's life. And like the artists are very excited to have that kind of scale, like getting art into people's hands. But one of the other interesting things about it is, you know, how do you balance the legacy of like exclusivity against this kind of
accessibility,
against the accessibility.
How do you do that?
I mean, I think that, you know, to me, a lot of it is about integrity. It's about, you know, and I think that one of the things that we're trying to make more visible to people outside is how much effort and attention and time and thoughtfulness goes into both the physical production of the print and its presentation. And that, you know, when we ship people a print, it comes with the artist's statement and care instructions for the print and a certificate of authenticity that the artist has signed. And, you know, those are things that we do to communicate that this is not disposable. This is a real thing that has had a lot of time and effort put into it. You know, and I think that there's nothing assembly line about what we're doing. So I think that as long as that's true in the spirit of what we're producing, then, I mean, it's the same thing with people thinking that in the early days that you had to know Jen Beckman to get a print. Like, each edition was 222 pieces and there were 4,000 people on the list. Like, the world is vast. 170,000 is nothing, you know?
Well, it's still pretty damn good considering.
But, you know, I really want everyone to collect art. I really want it to be something that people do in the same way that they read books or they talk about movies. I want it to be a part of everyone's life. And so while I'm very proud of what we've accomplished so far and sort of like all of those different stories and all, you know, we've worked with over 200 artists, I really think about how do we have 170 million stories at some point, you know, because the world's a big place. And, you know, I think that, you know, like we're just sort of scratching the surface of it.
I think there's a real mutuality going on because I think that it's wonderful that you can sell $100,000 worth of work by William Wegman in a day and 220 prints by William Poe-Hyda in 2 hours. But think about how wonderful it is for the people that have the opportunity to be able to do this because they can afford it.
Right.
And to have that then in their lives.
Right.
That's phenomenal. I read that you are very promiscuous in your taste, that you're always looking everywhere.
Said that.
Yes, you did. So what makes a great 20 by 200 artist? How do you choose who to represent and who to create editions with?
It's a combination of things. I mean, you know, one of the artists that we work with, Sarah McKenzie, I saw her in a exhibition at the Walker Museum and I like tracked her down because I like the work. You know, I find people online all the time. I find people in galleries, in magazines, you know, in a way I am living my dream of like reading magazines for a living. I just didn't know that a lot of them would be on the internet because I didn't know what the internet was. But, you know, I'm sort of always looking and it's interesting, like as I think about it, it really does go back to this appetite that I had as a kid of looking at magazines. You know, it wasn't like, oh, I had to read Vogue. It was, I really got excited about my stepfather's weekly issue of Crane's Business. And that's pretty dry. But like, you know, I'll look everywhere. And I think the fact that I'm willing to look everywhere is represented in the diversity of what we do. And then, you know, more and more as the site and the business has matured, each time we work with a new artist, it's not a one-off thing. We have ongoing relationships where, you know, like with Mike and Doug Starn, we've done 8 editions with them to date. We've worked with Bill Wegman several times. You know, it's an ongoing collaboration in almost every instance now. And so it's cumulative. And, you know, to me, that's a big important part of what we do as well, because I want artists to think of this as something that they can rely on in a toolkit of, you know, how they make it work to have their practice.
How is the art world reacting to you now? Are you a thorn in their side or are they accepting what you're doing with enthusiasm?
It varies a lot. I mean, to me, the biggest successes are people who really thought that I was the devil when I started doing what I was doing and have kind of come around. There are a lot of people that would like to discredit what we're doing as, you know, not being real art. And I think that there will always be detractors. But one of the things that I say all the time is that if everybody likes what you're doing something wrong. Or as my mom told me when I was little, they're just jealous. So I, you know, and it doesn't mean that it doesn't make me crazy when people try to undercut it. But, you know, by and large, there's an increasing amount of recognition and there are some people who will never be sold on it.
Well, Forbes magazine appointed you one of their 10 female entrepreneurs to watch. So congratulations.
Yay.
In that. Have there been a lot of copycats?
There have. I mean, I think that, you know, imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. I say that to myself often, balling up my fists.
I was going to say, but, while crying.
You know, no, I never cry.
Oh, good. Good. Good for you.
There's not, I mean, I'm the only person I know who was a writer and then an internet entrepreneur and then an art dealer and who also has been involved in like sort of online photo stuff from Photolog to Flickr to Tumblr. You know, I mean, 20 by 200 is a manifestation of a very disparate array of interests that I've had. And like loving Mickey Drexler is part of that as well. And so I don't really think that anyone is taking the approach that we're doing. And I feel very secure that the approach that we have is the right way. So I think it's hard to get it right. And I think that there's a lot of people in the world and a lot of art in the world. And we can't sell all the art to everyone. So I haven't seen someone doing it in a way yet that I feel like, oh, man, we're sunk. We're never going to be able to get out ahead of these people. And a part of that just has to do with the fact that, like, we really love what we're doing. And we're not going to stop doing it because someone else is doing it. I think, you know, to me, the thing that pushes me the most has far less to do with competition and more to do with art for everyone. And everyone is a lot of people. And how do we grow and maintain everything that makes the product special? And, you know, a sort of impatience to kind of both get there more quickly and also figure out how we get there.
I read that you have only one rule for collectors: buy art that you love.
Yes.
And there is a lot of art to love on 20 by 200. Jen, thank you so much for being on Design Matters.
Thank you.
To learn more about Jen Beckman, go to 20by200.com and definitely check out all of the amazing art. I'd like to thank you for listening. And remember, we can talk about making a difference, we can make a difference, or we can do both. I'm Debbie Millman, and I look forward to talking with you again soon.
Design Matters with Debbie Millman is recorded at the Masters in Branding Studio at the School of Visual Arts in New York City. It is produced by Curtis Fox Productions with technical assistance by Rainey Ortica and research by Jeff Close and Lisa Grant. The show is published exclusively by DesignObserver.com. You can subscribe to this free podcast in the iTunes Store.
You're growing a business, and you can't afford to slow down. If anything, you could probably use a few more hours in the day. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate, no coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.